Dorothy. The last poems were just like magical realism to me. And Gabriel Garcia Marquez.
Absolutely.
And the flowers coming out like yellow butterflies.
Absolutely.
From Wakanda.
Absolutely.
So how do you just relate to... Because I was thinking of surrealism.
Can you speak a little louder?
Oh, sorry.
Yeah.
Oh, sorry. So from surrealism, we just glided to this magic realism. So we just... Is this a journey?
What's your name again?
My Layli.
Layli?
Yeah.
Layli, if you guys didn't hear, Layli made a very generous comment that the last poem was a little bit like Marquez and magical realism, which is just a huge, huge compliment to be said in the same sentence. To me, I love Borges, I love Italo Calvino and Lorca. I love this kind of magical realism in poetry, especially. Let me say something, this is maybe parallel to some things that Cal was saying. For me, I'm not interested in a beautiful line. I don't care. I don't really want to be quoted. I don't want to have a line that somebody could take out and be like, oh, wow, listen to this. What I'm interested in is having you guys enter a space and then something happens to you in that space, you know? And then you come out of the space and you can't exactly describe it. In the sense, I think Cal was kind of saying this, like, could you create an entryway to a poem that looks like a normal house? It looks like a normal facade. And you go in and then you find yourself in a haunted house or a fun house or something like that. And you come out again. And you know what they say, like good art. I'm not throwing myself into that, but good art, hopefully, you cannot describe over the phone. You know, so it's like something happens to you in the space of the poem and then you come out. And you kind of can't exactly say what it was. So it's all about the experience of the being in the foliage and wilderness, the environment of being inside the poem. Like David Lynch says, you can't talk a film back into language because it's film. You know, you watch the film and something happens. The same is true for a poem, I think. Mm-hmm. Sorry, I'm just running with your wonderful question. Yes.
I will rephrase. Do you have a question or a comment? If it's a comment, then John will tell us something fascinating related to your comment. Anyone else?
Well, I just wonder, mentioned film, and I know you're very interested in film. Do you have a favorite director, or is it David Lynch?
I love David Lynch, yeah. Yeah. If you guys know, Mulholland Drive, there's like a scene in it, Club Silencio. There's a scene right in the middle of Mulholland Drive, which is like the dream within a dream. And it's, to me, this is like absolutely magic. It's incredible. Yeah. But there's too many to count. I love Tarkovsky. I love Barbara Loden. There's so many great directors.
Does anyone have questions related to the process of working with an editor, as Callie was talking about? Maybe you have a question or a comment for Callie? No. They are silent.
My friend Linda said that she had a good Q&A at their reading because they had a few plants. I didn't do my work and get a few plants. But, yeah.
Have you been writing, Cal?
Just recently?
Yeah.
Yeah. Well, not in this last few weeks because I've just been—it's been a busy few weeks. We closed up a family estate, and you were coming, and yeah. So, but other than that, I have been.
You had a question, yeah?
I have a question. Yes, you mentioned working with an editor, and that would sound to be a very personal, maybe. Intimate, very sensitive kind of zone. It's tough enough to just have a conversation with someone and meet something that would feel like a challenge. But when you've written something like this and you take it to an editor, what is that like?
Your question is, what is it like to talk about the editor?
Maybe have to rethink the work that you thought so much about already.
Yes.
Or how do you the relationship. It seems
yes.
Very,
yeah. Well,
very
I often think that that depends so much. The relationship must have so much to do with how a writer ends up feeling about his or her work with the editor. Because, I really felt that from the first conversation with the negative capability that I was speaking with someone who obviously really was well grounded in poetry, much more than I was. You know, I came to it later in my life, and I think most of my poetry reading were in literature classes way back. I don't think I could have at that time, you know, before I started this, named you all that many Canadian or contemporary poets. But I had friends who kept me up on that. But so I had a great trust. And from the first conversation, I felt like John is a poet of great affability, as one of his other reviewers Borders. Says. And it wasn't hard for me to accept if a poem needed culling, if it was too abstract, if it was too long. Some of my poems were too long, like really long. It was a good experience.
I think all writing can stand a good editor.
Yes, yes.
Can you add anything to that? Presumably you also work with an editor.
Yeah, I've worked with a number of editors. And like, to your point, we're tremendously vulnerable. These things that we've created, they're really important to us. And a lot of our sense of who we are and what we want in this life is dependent on these things we've written. So I'll tell you something that happens to me is if somebody I respect gives me a positive comment about one of my poems, I notice that the poem kind of solidifies a little bit, like it kind of turns into concrete, and it becomes harder for me to re-enter it. So that's why I try not to share poems sometimes when they're kind of in process, they're not ready, because it's a little dangerous, because they do need to change. They need to evolve in their natural kind of way. It's like taking a little plant and pulling it out, and it can't grow anymore. Mm-hmm. Natalie had her
question, yeah.
Well, I'm working with John right now, and like Callie, he's cut a lot of verses in my work. And at first, I thought, but I now recognize that it's a lot better. Yeah. So that, you know, you take a deep breath and it's okay.
For those of you in the back, she said, you take a deep breath and it's okay. That was the important piece.
So I have a question from the opposite point of view. If you could comment about being an editor for other people, what are the danger spots? Or
I don't know. I live down in the States, but I feel that I move like a Canadian. At least I feel that way. I have a kind of friendliness. In America, I lived in Philadelphia for a while, and I'm like, hello, how are you doing? And people in Philly are a little like... So I feel like that friendliness, whatever you call it, it's not totally real. It's just my social way of getting around. I feel that when I'm working with somebody as an editor, I need to throw that away. And I need to be real with people, because the poems are more important than our relationship, I think. That's the way I think of it. Like I think Natalie's a wonderful person, and so is Cal, but what we're working toward here is not our friendship. If that comes, that's a nice thing, but what we're working toward is, you know, this manuscript. So I just try to really trust myself and try to work with them and try to be brutally honest.
Right.
If I can.
And do you ever have clients who don't agree?
Oh, heck yeah. These are the two nicest poets I've worked with ever. Yeah. Yeah, people clearly, as you can imagine, don't like to hear that. I think I cut 15 poems from a manuscript that I was looking at recently. And, you know, people are like, you know, they usually go with it, but, like, usually it's a back and forth. Yeah, and I'll say I worked with some great editors. I worked with Don Mackay once, who's just one of the world class editors of Canada. And what he was able to do, and I admired this enormously, was He was not trying to make the work into his work.
Right.
That's quite good to remember, right? Mm-hmm. Like, I don't want people to write, I don't want Cal to write John Wilbarger poems. Mm-hmm. I want to, as an editor, I have to really listen. I have to get down on the ground with their work and try to understand what they're doing, what they're trying to do, and to encourage them to do that. So, and as teachers, there's probably a few teachers in the room, it's a tricky thing, this kind of editing and making comments, because what you're trying to do is you're trying to figure out how they missed the mark, like what they were aiming for. And that's not obvious either, is it? This is what they're aiming for, and this is how they missed the mark, and then this is how you say it to them. You know, yeah. How you say it to them is not always simple either. Mm-hmm. So you have to read people. And there's some assumptions there as well. You can't know. You have to trust yourself. Is that a...
Yeah, I was just wondering if you ever have changed your mind.
Yeah. It's, I mean, at its base, I think it's really a subjective mm-hmm. process. Absolutely. It's not objective. My wife is an analytic philosopher. And she reminds me all the time. She's like, this is subjective, what you're doing. So what we're doing is I'm just trusting myself. I trust myself as an editor a lot. So, and I just try to find something that we can do with this manuscript that is, in my opinion, you know, it is my opinion still, better. And we find somebody like Cal. You can't do everything either, right? So with Cal and I, it was like trying to get Cal to think of the reader and to let the reader in at the beginning and then to truncate the poems when possible, to not have extra stuff. But with somebody else, it's going to be something different. Yeah. And just do what you can with the limited time that you have.
Anyone else?
Well, thank
you. It's dark out. You guys have been here for like a while.
I want to thank you very much for coming. Thank you. It's just wonderful to see you here. It's great. And I wanted to thank the people from this fabulous bookstore. I want to thank Joanna and Oscar and the rest of the staff that helped with this. Novel idea, and we all have attended many readings here. Bruce, you probably more than anyone. And it's wonderful. So thank you very much. Heartfelt
and,
thanks.
There's lots of snacks out.
Okay.
And some baked goods.
Yes. There's wine books. And snacks
books,
back
books
there.
And
so indulge. Okay, and thank you. Thanks.
And you just heard from a May 4th lunch and reading with touring poet John Wilbarger. You heard and his latest collection, Resurrection Pie. And you heard his reading from that, and also local poets Liz Huntley Jens, and it was emceed by Callista Markatich. And you heard some of her poetry as well. It is 13 minutes or almost after, in fact, it is just over 13 minutes after 5 o'clock. I'd like to thank all of you out there for having tuned in to the first segment of this show today. Again, thank John, Liz, and Callista, Novel Idea, for that wonderful event. And I hope you can stay tuned to the second hour for another event that was held in April. You have been listening to Finding a Voice on CFRC 101.9 FM. Just a reminder that I upload both hours of this show to my personal blog space for it, and they will remain there for 3 years at Finding a Voice on cfrcfm.wordpress.com. Maybe I'll give a little better introduction to this second hour when we come back from just a few messages here. I'll be right back.
Profound. I think you. When it comes to Kingston real estate, local experience matters. Kim Purcell is an award-winning realtor born and raised in Kingston with over a decade of experience and 100 five-star reviews. If you want honest advice and results you can trust, choose Kim. Visit kimpurcell.ca today for more information.
Mm-hmm. Folk Everything is your passport to the finest in folk music. Old, new, and everything in between. The wonderful, the wild, and the weird.
Walk quietly by, he won't bother you. He's a busy man, he's got things to do.
It's all here Saturdays from 10 a.m. until 1 p.m. Folk Everything with Hugh on CFRC 101.9 FM in Kingston.
Friday evenings at 6 p.m. here on CFRC, listen to Saltwater Music, a show covering all musical genres from the East Coast of Canada. Celtic, of course, but also rock, jazz, blues, folk, and a lot more. I'm your host, Rob Carnell. Tune in to Saltwater Music Friday evening from 6 to 8 here on CFRC 101.9 FM. Or you can catch us on the web at www.cfrc.ca. And for our listeners out east, that's 7 p.m. Atlantic and 7:30 Newfoundland.
Wouldn't it be wonderful if you could borrow a musical instrument free of charge, just like you can borrow books from your local library? We think so too. That's why the Joe Chitlin Memorial Musical Instrument Lending Library, also known as Joe's Mill, has been lending guitars, keyboards, saxophones, and many other instruments to the Kingston community free of charge for almost 20 years. We are a registered charity, relying solely on the generosity of our community to donate their time, money, and instruments to keep this amazing service alive. Find us at www.joesmill.org or Joe's Mill on Facebook for more information on borrowing instruments or contributing to Joe's Mill.
And welcome back to this second segment. You are and have been listening to Finding a Voice here on CFRC 101.9 FM. We are located in Lower Carruthers Hall, Queen's University, Kingston, Ontario. My name is Bruce. I'm here every Friday afternoon from 4 to 6 o'clock. And we do stream live online as well at www.cfrc.ca. And just a reminder again, in case you happen to tune in just the last couple of minutes, that every week I do upload both hours of this show to my personal blog space for it at Finding a Voice on cfrcfm.wordpress.com. They do remain there for 3 years. I usually get that done shortly after I get home, so usually about 7 o'clock this evening. And it is now just after 17 minutes after 5 o'clock. And in case you might have tuned in late in the first hour, or even just tuned in now at the start of the second hour, in the first hour, especially since I also let you know that you can still hear it again in case you missed it or wanted to rehear part of it, in the first hour you did hear from a May 4th launch and reading with touring poet John Wall Barjar and his latest collection of poetry called Resurrection Pie, reading with and launching that book, but reading with local poets Liz Huntley-Yentz and Calista Markatich, who emceed the event. Again, that was at Novel Idea Bookstore. And now coming up in the second hour, I believe this was held March 26th at Novel Idea. I think I got that date right. You're going to hear an event that was put together by Creative Writings. You're going to hear another book launch event. It is an April 9th. That's why I had things confused. Book launch at Novel Idea Bookstore. And you're going to hear Molly Cronin launching her new book called Future Me is Fat. That happens to also be her first book of comics. You're going to hear her in conversation with Nalina Valji, who is a PhD student in gender studies at Queen's University. I attended both of these events, obviously, and I enjoyed them both very much, the events that I'm airing today. So it's been a while. I'm happy to get them to the air. Let's go ahead and jump right into this one.
Silage is just follow me on Instagram for all the gender studies people in the room. Wow. Now you're famous.
Yeah. Uh-huh. Now it's real. Okay, we'll get started. Is that good for you, Bruce?
It's all good. Yeah. Good?
Okay, so we're welcoming Molly here today to talk about her new book, Future Me is Fat. Woo! I'm just going to read a little bio. So Molly Cronin is a cartoonist from Halifax and Fredericton. Since 2015, she's been creating comics and illustrations under the name Art Brat Comics, where she tersely tackles modern dating, fat phobia, and gender dynamics. If you are fat and have access to the internet, you know about Molly and probably own some of her art. I do. Did I bring it to force you to sign it? Yes, I did. Her work has appeared on Hulu's Shrill in illustrations in books such as Molly Forbes' Everybody, as tattoos, and as a monthly strip comic in Altwigney. She's taught several courses in the Extended Studies program at NASCAD. There we go.
Yeah, unintuitive.
NASCAD, and has lectured at Dalhousie, U of T in Queens. She holds a BA in Art History from NASCAD University and an MA in Gender Studies from Queens University. She is currently living in Toronto, where she is a PhD student at York. And this is her first book of comics. First of many, we hope. So I think we would want to start with, I would love to hear a little bit of background on your work. Mm-hmm. Have you always been an artist? When did you start drawing comics? And where does the name Art Brat come from?
Well, first of all, thank you, Nalina Velji, for joining me today. I had a bio of yours, and I have left it somewhere, and I'm just going to talk about how wonderful you are, and you're a Queens gender studies person as well, so thank you for talking with me today. The question was about my art practice. Broadly.
Yeah. Broadly, yeah. What brought you to comics? When did you start?
I grew up in a family of artists, which is sort of where the name Art Brat Comics comes from. And that doesn't really come up in this book, I suppose, but it's if you're familiar with my online presence or my other work, that's the name I often publish under. And it was the name of my strip comic in The Coast as well, the Alt Weekly in Halifax. And it's a joke about being a person from an artist's family, like the way that a Navy brat or an Army brat is somebody who grew up in a military family. An art brat is like the weird particular kind of person you become when you grow up with parents who are artists. And I think many people, like, perhaps grow up with parents with other jobs and grow up and dream to become artists, and I was sort of the opposite. I was reluctant to join the family business, so to speak. I was like, I'm going to rebel. I'm going to go to liberal arts college. And then I eventually sort of softened and discovered my own pathway. I had an interest in writing and an interest in drawing, and I could never really decide between the two. And comics became a really natural marrying of my, like, loves of both media, and I fell into comics after my time at NASCAD when I was kind of entering my parents' world, and my mother was an instructor there, and I was referred to as like Sarah's daughter at the school. Now she's Art Brat Comics' mom when she goes there, which she gets a big kick out of. But when I graduated, I think I was really hung up while I was in university about what an artist was, and I knew what it took. I had seen so many people I knew grow up in that, and I was didn't think I fit that, and so it took until after I graduated, and I started experimenting in comics. I was sitting in an archive, and I was doodling when I should have been scanning, and I drew a little comic of myself, feeling frustrated about how long it was taking to archive, and something happened, and that night I went home, and I drew, I don't know, 24 more comics, and it became this really great place for me to talk about my relationship to my body and to the kind of, like, feminism I was developing in my 20s, and it became a really accessible way to both, like, capture it and communicate it, and then, like, through Instagram, kind of, like, share it that way and develop a community online. Which you've,
proud member of. So your parents must have been really excited that you joined the family business.
Yeah, it's kind of a joke because, like, my dad is a writer and my mom is an artist, and I, you know, have married those two somehow and become. What does the child of an artist and a writer do? They make comics, I guess.
So can you tell us a little bit about your art practice? How did you make the transition from short form comics to writing a book?
Very quickly and very nervously. My primary place of publishing was like 3-panel short strip comics in a newspaper. in Halifax, and then sort of like for Instagram, and you don't need to write a lot. And I liked that about comics. I liked how quickly I could capture an emotion or a current event and communicate something about that in the form. And so it was like, it was intimidating to like figure out, like, can I write something longer than three panels? Do I know how to do it? But I had I did this great thing where I started I went back to school and started a PhD program, and should have been like writing the book that I had agreed to do, but instead I was doing schoolwork. And then the deadline was quickly approaching, and I had to I had about a month to write the entire thing. And so it was sort of germinating while I was here in Kingston and at Queens, and through my friendship with Charlie Atkinson, who is right here. Oh, right here. got me interested in thinking about science fiction. And my work had always been about myself, but not maybe always disclosing a lot about my life. I was maybe kind of not interested in cataloging my own personal history so much as I was interested in talking about like current events and feminism and the frustrations I was having in relationships or about my body, and learning how to communicate that in a way that it helped other people and not just was sort of always so self-referential. And I don't know if I achieved that, but the book was like a way to expand that practice and dive a little more into the fiction side of things. And it's, we might call it like auto-fiction, where I'm a character in it. And it gets really confusing when I'm writing about it or talking about it, because I never know whether it is, I'm like, me, Molly, the character, but also me writing this right now.
Very meta.
Yeah, or like tiny Molly, or Smalley, as little Molly is called. It's for small Molly. But it was a really great exercise to learn how to challenge myself. And now I'm talking with Conundrum Press about doing like a much, like a full-length graphic novel, because we might call this a mini-comic. And we'll see if I can pull it out of the bag that time.
Do you already have ideas on topics?
Yes, there's a few. Like, there's interest in maybe doing something slightly more autobiographical, like moving away from science fiction, because this book is a time travel story where I am the protagonist, and I travel back in time and forward in time and meet past versions of myself, and we talk about what kind of expectations they have had about what we would look like in the future, our relationships to our bodies, and how fat bodies are kind of understood and interpreted in different time periods. What does it mean for an ancestor, you know, my ancestor during the Irish famine, to see that they have a descendant who is fat? Is that like a potentially hopeful kind of conversation? And what kind of futures can I imagine? Because when I was researching fat characters in sci-fi, because I'm always like blending the comics world and the academic world, because I am a nerd but don't want to, but also really want to avoid my schoolwork and do my comics.
We love to procrastinate.
And I was discovering that a lot of the science fiction I was seeing either didn't have fat people in it, and I was curious about why and how, and or if they did, it was a sign of like a scary future, a dystopia. And so I talk about that a little bit in the book, in this kind of like lighthearted and funny way, as comics often are, or at least my comics often are, and imagine a future where people can decide what their bodies look like. And I think in the age of Ozempic, we're thinking a lot about Ozempic promises a future without fat people, and I was curious about what a future with fat people might look like, and I designed a dance party. It's very like deceptively kind of simple way to approach it, but also hopeful. I don't know if that answers your question.
Yeah, well, I mean, that actually is a good segue into my next question.
Okay.
Which is what I was saying, throughout your comic, you visit past and future selves and ancestors, cataloging a spectrum of fat experiences, including the fat utopia taking place in outer space. I found that section as a fat person to be very beautiful and like a really hopeful depiction of fat joy. Like, as you said, we often see fatness as a punchline or a threat.
Yeah.
And I was wondering if there was a reason you made the particular choice for it to be in space.
Yeah, I think I was like reading so much about sort of very classic sci-fi, and it's this kind of like Jetsons type world where there's like flying cars, and often this kind of like food replacement technology, like food pills. So I was interested in the kind of like simple visual language of science fiction and tapping into that, but then also kind of like sneaking in these bigger ideas about what does a hopeful future look like? Mm-hmm. And I was thinking a lot about even something as simple as like a Disney film like WALL-E, which is a movie about where the earth is dead and also mm-hmm. everybody is fat, and those are treated as sort of very connected and kind of equally as bad. Mm-hmm. And as the earth heals, everyone gets thin. Like, yes. Isn't that convenient?
Yeah.
And, so I was imagining, I thought a lot about like what is a hopeful future, and I thought about it being like, I thought about like not erasing these ideas of these food pills that are part of the genre, and also the kind of current reality of GLP-1s. Like, they're mm-hmm. in the book, but people in this story decide whether or not they would like to control their body, and mm-hmm. this idea of, if once we can control these things about our body, you know, if we can in the future, maybe people might decide to be fat, and it might be something that is like lovely to them and desirable to them. And I made the choice not to end it with the dance party, especially because I knew it was like leaning into this idea of utopia, of like mm-hmm. a perfect future. And I have the descendant, the, you know, this character in the future, we're talking, and I say, like, is everything in the future perfect? Because I've just been to this amazing dance party. And she says, well, no, I'm only showing you like this little part of it. Your little caveman brain couldn't handle everything else. And I did that in particular because I didn't want to say like the future is going to be perfect, or mm-hmm. or a fat future is utopia. Like, I just wanted to offer this idea that in whatever world we might imagine, perhaps mm-hmm. we could also imagine fatness there, yeah. and fatness as joyful. And then I conclude the story with like it a little bit more vague. Like, I kind of travel through space, and it's left a little more open because I, what else might happen out there? In the yeah. world?
I mean, not to make this about me. this year I went to FatCon for the first time, and it kind of reminded me a lot of that section of the book, because...
Can you tell them what FatCon is?
Yeah, so FatCon is the biggest fat convention in North America. It's in Seattle. It's a mix of, like, academic lectures, and then there's also, like, how to run for city council, how to move your body, rope binding for fat bodies, sex pleasure, sex work, lots of different things. And on the second night, it ends with a dance party. And then on the last day, the morning is a fashion show, fat fashion show, and the afternoon is a pool party. And it was like one of the most incredible experiences I've ever had. And your scene about the dance party, I was like, I got to live that.
Yeah.
Like, you know, it's possible now, but it is lovely to think about it being more widespread accepted.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And I was thinking, like, when I was young and I was growing up and I was... did not feel good in my fat body, I would look around the room and I would try to figure out where I was in the scale. Was I the fattest person in the room? Mm-hmm. And hope that I wasn't. And I wasn't looking to connect with the people that were as fat as me or fatter than me. I thought I didn't see the potential of connection there. And I feel the opposite now. And when I see another fat person, I think, oh, great, I'd like a new friend or like somebody else who has these experiences. Mm-hmm. And I think that we see this, I try to capture that in this book. I think we see that in shows like Shrill, mm-hmm. Where fat people getting together and like our bodies being together is something. There is something significant, and there is something like beautiful and kind of like a resistance there too.
Yeah, absolutely. So that really actually segues again. You're doing really great. That goes into my next question. So I was also wondering about how you got your start in fat studies,
mm-hmm.
and what brought you to this work. Because for me, I hadn't heard about fat liberation until about 2018. And it was the first time that someone told me I didn't have to hate myself as like penance for living in a fat body. And I'm wondering if there was a moment like that for you, and what made you, like you briefly talked on this, but what made you feel like you needed to explore that through comics?
I think that all of these things were happening at the perfect time for me, right? The kind of rise of a very palatable body positive movement, for all of its maybe flaws, it opened me up to this idea, and it was happening in the same places that I was drawing and I was doing things, and the kind of feminism I was learning about in art school, I was already starting to critique things like beauty standards and things like what makes a body valuable or not, and so fatness was like became part of that for me, and it was part of the education I got in ASCAD. And then it was a matter of like thinking about how to understand my own body through that. If I could understand that the women hating their bodies in particular, I mean, that was the kind of like place I was coming from. Women hating their bodies does not serve those women. It serves this like patriarchal structure. Mm-hmm. Then I should probably figure out how to not hate my body. And there's something important in doing that work. Mm-hmm. And I maybe didn't feel it right away, but I made drawings. I kind of made the drawings that I wish I had seen growing up, the kind of images of fat women. And there's a kind of romanticizing we get of like Renaissance art, for example, of the kind of bodies we see in there. And those are really beautiful and important. There's also a kind of complicated relationship to whiteness and white supremacy about them, right? So we thinking a little bit more broadly and thinking about like what images did I need to see, especially growing up in the 90s and early 2000s, like the kind of heroin chic fashion look of the very, very skinny supermodel in the 90s. And the this really critical pop culture conversation about fatness we had in the early 2000s with, think about the kind of like reality TV we had in the early 2000s of The Biggest Loser or Honey, the Kids Are Fat or whatever that one was called, like where they show the parents like what their kids might look like when they grow up if they keep not, if they stay fat, basically, and like what a horrible future their fat future is.
Think about like revenge body.
Yeah. We were so inundated with it growing up, and it took me a little while to kind of like deprogram myself, like I think like many of us, which is what is so maybe stressful about the kind of current moment we're in of like a diet culture and thin fixation on thinness that we're seeing today. Is like, didn't we do this already? Like, I thought didn't we learn anything? So I started making this work in the 2010s, and it was making these images I wish I had seen, making images of myself, but also other bodies, and sort of working my way up to feeling the way maybe the characters I was drawing felt, the kind of autonomy they felt and the power they felt and the confidence they felt. I maybe didn't feel right away and don't always feel every single day, but faking it till I make it, and also maybe kind of like manifesting it by creating those images, and also by creating those images of like beautiful and powerful and funny and messy fat women and other bodies, that maybe people who look like that also might feel some of those things and see themselves represented where we had so little.
Yeah. And so while you were still struggling with feeling maybe in fat lib, fat feeling good.
Oh yeah.
You were like doing this work and creating a community. Was that also impacting how you were seeing your own body?
Definitely, yes. And I knew that was part of why I was doing it. But I knew it couldn't just be about myself. That I wasn't interested in this kind of vanity project, even though like I wrote a book with that character and I talked to many versions of myself. Like, how vain can you get? But I think of like I had my own material to work with. I could make fun of myself without really like belittling myself, I guess. And I felt comfortable doing that because I have these kind of two sides to the drawing practice. There's the comics, the kind of humorous, like, you know, narrative comics where I'm a character, and then there's the illustrations, there's the drawings of fat bodies. You've got, no, I didn't do those, Phoebe Wall did those. I got confused. I did one with that same jeweler, but yeah, sorry. These images that are sort of like the kind of relationship to the body I hope to have and hope to inspire in others. And then eventually I started, as my relationship to these images and to I don't know, to feminism became more complex naturally over time, and I eventually like entered academia, I could start studying it. I could start figuring out like where do my comics and illustrations fit into a larger conversation, like into the history of comics, and that's what I'm studying now in school and what I did my master's in here at Queens. And sort of doing the artwork somewhere in the mix of all of that academic studying.
Yeah, I think it balances it out, right?
Yeah.
So I wanted to ask you a question. I would argue that your work is inherently political, because you're challenging normative ideas about beauty, sensuality, joy, and femininity when centering the fat body.
Yeah.
But you also make a point of including queer and racialized bodies alongside a pinned post on your Instagram supporting Palestine. And I'm wondering how activism functions within your work.
I thought about that a lot because I'll often get called an activist, and I sometimes, maybe the way that I resisted artists when I was young, I was like, I didn't earn that, I don't deserve that. I sometimes feel that way about activists because I'm not organizing, I'm not doing the kind of activist work that so many of my like loved ones and peers are doing. Mm-hmm. And so I think that I'm so, in the same way that I had my own stories and body to talk about, I also have art as a way to talk about the things that are important to me. Mm-hmm. And I was at a talk recently with another cartoonist named Jessica Campbell, and she was asked the question, does art have to be political? And she answered it in a way that I appreciated, which was that, like, I think everybody has to be political. I think that it's not so much that I have to, I always make art that is responding to the current moment, although sometimes I do, but I think that art is part of the life that I'm living, and the life I'm living is thinking critically about systems and wanting to change them. And, mm-hmm. and it becomes really natural to want to talk about changing the world when you are wanting that to happen. Mm-hmm. Whether art does that is a bigger question, one that I cannot answer, whether comics can do that. But I think that creating, like proposing other worlds and thinking about other ways of living in the world are part of what I'm interested in, and I think art and comics can be a part of that. I think storytelling can be a part of that, and yeah, I pinned the Palestine post because I want everybody to know exactly how I feel. I don't want anyone to show up there and not and be in the wrong place. So that's what I think.
Yeah, and it sounds like your activism within your art is just an extension of how you already are moving through the world.
I think that's how I would explain it. Yeah.
Yeah.
So, yeah. Yeah.
Does anyone have any questions for Molly? Other Molly.
Sorry, fantastic. First of all, the comic is fantastic.
Thank you, Molly.
I borrowed Charlie's copy and blasted through it. It was fantastic. Talking about FatCon and about kind of ideas of fat joy, were there any other kind of routes you thought about going down through the scope of sci-fi about where fat joy is in the future?
I mean, I think I narrowed, I think I kept it small because I had to cut like 40 pages from this book. It was already so long, and it's part of a series of other comics from Conundrum Press, and he was like, this is twice as big as everybody else's book. It's gonna look bananas next to the rest. You have to make it smaller. It was like, ironic, I guess. Sure. Sure. Of course. So, and for me, it became, I maybe didn't have like explicit ways of thinking about fat joy in the future, except I was thinking a lot about, this is very like heady and nerdy and academic, but there's this idea of called fat time or temporality in fat studies, where you're thinking like if capitalism shrinks time, or and makes it very small and very tight and you're very restricted by it, what, And there's so much about fat bodies that is connected to time, right? The idea of the before and after picture is related to time, or this idea that you are always looking back to a thinner version of yourself that you wish you appreciated, or dreaming of a thinner future, right? That the fat body is sort of suspended in time. That it's not the real time you're occupying. And there's a bunch of scholars that write about these ideas on fat temporality and fat time, and you know, without getting too academic here, I tried to draw some of that. I tried to draw this idea of, well, what if we thought about time differently? What if time wasn't restricted? What if we weren't bound by these, by capitalism in the same way, or feeling like our body needed to change to live a life that we wanted? And so in all of these transition scenes between visiting past and future versions of myself, between the spaces I go to time travel, like the cave people and the Irish famine and the future dance party, there's these scenes of me like as kind of part of space, and space itself and time itself are drawn as fat. And so one of the exercises I do when I teach comics is I ask people to like draw a place that is fat and think of words that are synonymous with fat. And so things that are bountiful, things that are ample, things that are rolling and changing and growing, and you know, and I tried to capture some of that visually, so that the academics could be like very good, but that I don't, but no one else reading that is like, why is she talking about like Benjamin right now? Like nobody cares. So, so I tried to sort of sneak in these ideas about fatness and changing the world with fatness in these like visual ways. Bye, gender studies guys.
Bye.
Yeah, Hannah.
You're so cool and smart.
You're so funny. Cool and smart.
That's not all I had to say, though. I would love to hear more about how, like, doing these comics helped you build, like, fat yeah. community and, like, what it feels like to be in community with other fat people. Like, that's my best friend, and she's fat, and I'm fat, and it's so beautiful yeah. and wonderful. Like, even, like, something as simple as, like, sharing clothes.
Yes.
Like, just, like, stuff yeah. like that. It's so, it's, like, stuff that you don't have access to as a fat person in so many ways.
Yeah.
And I think... Yeah, I've also been following you for forever. But anyways, I want to hear more about, like, what that was like for you.
Yeah,
what it is like.
I think, like, it's not an accident that I start this book by visiting little me, by visiting Smalley, and thinking about where some of these feelings came from and the kind of world I was growing up in and how it was maybe, like, unavoidable, right? And when you never see a fat body represented, like, positively or even neutrally in the media you see growing up, it makes you think that there's something wrong about your body when you hear everyone around you talking about their body in negative ways and about how scary it is to become fat. There's a reason, like, I named this book Future Me is Fat, and I was nervous about it at first. I thought it would be very controversial and, like, mm-hmm. I would have to explain it a lot. But it's, like, talking about this idea that when I was growing up, it was an impossible future to think of myself as fat. And so, yeah, so when you feel like you're the only fat person in the world or in the room or in the friend group or in the family or whatever it is, it feels so isolating and you feel very alone. Mm-hmm. And when I think, like, the first thing that changed for me was just even adopting the word fat as neutral or positive mm-hmm. because... it for many people still is not, and historically, you know, for many of us has not been a word that we like to hear about ourselves, right? And so taking that and saying, no, I am fat, and it's the same as saying I am tall or I have curly hair. It's just a descriptor, but that also, like, there's something maybe, like, revolutionary cool about using it. And it's so nice to share clothes with your friends. I never knew.
It's really nice.
It's so nice to go have, like, a clothing swap or just, like, yeah, to talk with other people who have similar experiences with you mm-hmm. at least in regards to this kind of, like, way of living in a body or, you know, this part of living in this kind of body. And fat hugs are so nice. And I think, like, now I'm so grateful I've cultivated those relationships as we're in this moment where, like, so much of the media is once again telling you that you must be thin, and the kind of images we were maybe seeing of fat people in the media are kind of, like, shrinking away. Mm-hmm. The celebrities that we maybe were looking to as beacons are shrinking also. And that's, you know, neither here nor there. That's their own decision. But it does impact us when we are craving that. So I think, like, finding those in my real relationships, like with my friends and with my peers, and having people doing research that are fat, and having mentors that are fat, and having friends that are fat is the best. Mm. Any other questions? Yeah, Molly again.
I loved getting to see fat people throughout history. Because of course, yeah, we've always been here. We've always been around. But I think going into art and making comics and enjoying the fact that we can, like, make touchstones in history, like, hey, writing about what's happening in our communities and things like that, through research in school and even for this book, what kind of fat characters in media and history came up that you really, like, loved or connected with?
You're assuming I did any research for this. Well, we just talked to Charlie and then wrote this book. I had to do it very quickly. I think about the kind of, like, media that I see about fat people, and sometimes it's still, like, I just saw the John Candy movie, and I was like, this is so great. And then they're like, and it was so sad that he was so fat. And you're like, we're still missing some of these conversations. So is your question about, like, what other, like, places in history or other people that I want to talk about, or, like, what
are in like art, media, and things like that?
I think I don't know if I feel like I'm, like, skirting your question every time. I don't know if I have, like, a particular person I really am excited to talk about, but I am excited to talk about, like, challenging this idea that fat people kind of only exist now. I think there's an idea that it's like a modern or contemporary problem. This, you know, the quote unquote epidemic, like this idea that we are, it is a problem, a symptom of our current world, and that is a problem. Mm-hmm. When of course, like, that's not true. I wrote about in a very small scene. I think a lot of people miss it because I drew it right. Just little, but when I travel back in time to see the like cave women and they're drawing fat bodies on the wall, I made that part up. But one of them is carving a little statue of a fat woman, and that is an art historical reference. It's called the Venus of Willendorf, and it is a Neolithic statue of a fat woman, mm-hmm. right? And there it, and. One of the theories is that it was like a self-portrait because it's kind of like angled kind of like this, and I just like this idea of resisting this idea of fatness as a problem in this time period, right? That fat people have always existed, and whether or not we were always paying attention or representing them, and trying to bring forward the women and the people that were making that art and were living those lives, and that was my little nod to that. So it doesn't really answer your question.
No,
thank you.
Yeah.
Any other questions?
No one else? Okay. Let's thank Molly for her time. We're so grateful to have you, and this was I loved your book, so it was so nice to be able to talk to you about it.
Thank you, Nalina. Thanks, everybody.
And you just heard in this second hour and following the remainder of the first hour's book launch reading, you heard from an April 9th book launch at, again, Novel Idea Bookstore, Molly Cronin launching her new book called Future Me is Fat, and it is her first book of her comics. And that was held in conversation with Nalina Velji, who is a PhD student in gender studies at Queen's University. I'd like to thank them both for the wonderful event, and also, again, Novel Idea Bookstore for everything they do for everything they do for both writers and readers in this community. It is actually 52 minutes after 5 o'clock. Only have a few minutes left here today, and I do have some recorded messages for the last 3 or 4 minutes of this show. So first thing I'd like to do is to thank all of you out there for tuning in today. And also, and I hope you enjoyed the show. I'm going to hopefully get into more book launch events over the course of the next few weeks. Next week, though, I will be going back and pulling up I haven't aired the April open mic and the Journey Continues open mic, so I plan to do that hopefully next week. And I also want to thank, again, all of the people whose work I shared today, and again to Novel Idea and Oscar, Joanna, and Nicola at that store for their time and space for all of this. Again, thank you. You have been listening to Finding a Voice here on CFRC 101.9 FM. We are located in Lower Carruthers Hall, Queen's University, Kingston, Ontario. My name is Bruce. Here every Friday from 4 to 6. We do stream live online as well at www.cfrc.ca. Again, I think I've mentioned it at least once, maybe twice already, but just a reminder that I do each week I upload both hours of this show to my personal blog space for it at Finding a Voice on cfrcfm.wordpress.com. They do remain there for 3 years. I usually get that uploaded just before 7 o'clock or so. I try to do it as quickly as I get home. I will go ahead and mention it's 2 weeks out, this will be the 12th annual Poets at Art Fest. And as part of Art Fest Kingston 2026, this is going to run Friday, Saturday, and Sunday, June 26th, 27th, and 28th. The first day will also include an evening event. It also includes a workshop, early morning workshop the first day, and it's going to bring some local and also some regional poets in, 60 of them altogether over the course of 3 days. So hope you can check that out. There is a Facebook announcement for it, so you can find out more there. There are also more closer. There are three book launch events coming up, or book launch or reading events coming up in this week. So Monday, Stuart Ross, Jamie Forsyth, and Lisa Fishman will be launching their book at Novel Idea Books at Novel Idea on Monday, June 15th. Quirks of Human Nature is a monthly combination of improvised music and poetry that's happening at Time Out Bar and Bistro on Tuesday, June 16th. And Novel Idea again on a book launch at Novel Idea on Wednesday, June 17th at 7 p.m. Called Francis Kelly with the Healing Tree. Please do stay tuned for 2 hours of East Coast music and a show called Saltwater Music, hosted by Rob Carnell. That's coming up right at the end of this hour. Let's go ahead and thank you all for tuning in today. Let's go ahead and just jump back into these.
Your library, your story. At the Kingston Frontenac Public Library, books are just the beginning. A library card starts a lifelong adventure, connecting you to everything you need to inspire learning, creativity, and fun. With 16 locations and plenty of online services, using your library has never been easier. Study in a quiet space, meet friends and learn new things, or explore the world through a magazine or a museum pass. Become a part of our story. Visit your local library branch or find us online at kfpl.ca.
Friday evenings at 6 p.m. here on CFRC, listen to Saltwater Music, a show covering all musical genres from the East Coast of Canada. Celtic, of course, but also rock, jazz, blues, folk, and a lot more. I'm your host, Rob Carnell. Tune in to Saltwater Music Friday evening from 6 to 8 here on CFRC 101.9 FM. Or you can catch us on the web at www.cfrc.ca. And for our listeners out east, that's 7 p.m. Atlantic and 7:30 Newfoundland.
Hey, 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 you want to kick the summer heat and get a nice treat? Don't hesitate to make a date to visit Old Farm Fine Foods. Pizza, frittata, sausage rolls, sandwiches, soups, and more are ready and waiting to get in your belly. Plus, you can also buy fresh and frozen food to prepare at home. Pop into the shop Monday through Sunday between 8 to 6 at 204 Berry Street. And don't forget to follow Old Farm Fine Foods on Instagram at OldFarmFF to get the scoop on the latest goodies. Old Farm Fine Foods, comfort food you can count on.
Hello and welcome to Salt Licked in Rapture. I'm your host, Nishan Tung. Salt Licked in Rapture is a sonic exploration of, to quote Virginia Woolf, violent waves of emotion. Featuring both known and lesser-known musicians and poets, a special emphasis is placed on oddball, enigmatic, outsider artists whose work invokes dreamscapes and feelings of alienation, nostalgia, melancholy, existential unease, and yearning. Join me on Fridays at 8 p.m. on CFRC 101.9 FM.
Folk Everything is your passport to the finest in folk music. Old, new, and everything in between. The wonderful, the wild, and the weird.
Walk quietly by, he won't bother you. He's a busy man, he's got things to do.
It's all here Saturdays from 10 a.m. until 1 p.m. Folk Everything with Hugh on CFRC 101.9 FM in Kingston.
No static. No static. No static. No static. Mondays. 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 Mondays, 6 to 8. 6 to 8. 6 to 8. 6 to 8 p.m. 6 to 8 p.m. Mondays, 6 to 8 p.m. CFRC 101.9. CFRC.ca. No Static. Mondays, 6 to 8 p.m. CFRC 101.9. CFRC.ca. CFRC's most varied variety.